Yeah, okay.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February 4th, 2016. Before we begin today, I want to provide some information on three issues: the order of operations today, the expectations of decorum in the room, and restrictions on testimony. We will begin this afternoon with a public hearing and work session on House Bill 4045, House Bill 4075, and then move on to public hearing on House Bill 4147. There is overflow seating in hearing room E. If you're not planning to testify, please consider viewing the hearing upstairs in E. After the first panel, we'll hear public testimony from those who are signed up, alternating panels of those in support and or in opposition. The expectations of decorum during the hearing: in accordance with legislative protocol, we do not permit signs, clapping, shouting from the audience, or disrupting the hearing or your fellow Oregonians who are speaking. If this happens, I'll have the committee immediately stand at ease until order is restored. Any time lost will not be added to the end of the meeting. Therefore, disruption will limit the opportunities of you and your fellow Oregonians to testify. If the disruption continues, we will recess the meeting and the individuals will be asked to leave the hearing room. Please do not exit from the doors marked media. Instead, enter and exit from the doors to my right. Remember, there is an overflow seating in room E. Public testimony will be taken in the following way: an opening panel from the proponents. Next, we will hear from those who have identified themselves on the witness registration as having traveled more than 100 miles to be here. We will then return to the top of the sign-up sheet and go in order, alternating panels of those who are opposed and those in support. It is the goal today to hear from as many Oregonians who have taken the time to come here, but to do this, we will be asking you to limit your testimony to 3 minutes. The clock behind the committee will be controlled by our committee staff, and when the time is up, it will beep. If necessary, we will ask you to conclude. We expect you to respect the time limit, our staff, and everyone waiting to testify. People will be called in panels of three, with people on deck being asked to sit in the three chairs against the wall. If you have written testimony, please hand it in to the committee staff as you come up to the dais, or you can email it to the committee at hjud.exhibits@state.or.us, and we'll keep the record open until 5 p.m. on Friday, so you have time to get those in. When you come to the dais, please identify yourself by name for the record. It is a recorded hearing. The first item is we'll open a hearing, public hearing on House Bill 4145. Call Chief Justice Ballmer and Judge Mooney, please, and Rep. Davis.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, this is House Bill 4145 and is brought to us today by Chief Justice Ballmer. There is no revenue impact. The fiscal impact is almost $3 million in this biennium, and there is a subsequent to Ways and Means. The pay rate for Oregon judges is among the lowest in the nation. House Bill 4145 makes it the policy in Oregon to pay judges no less than the median salary for judges serving in comparable positions in comparable states. It also raises the current annual salary for Oregon judges and establishes annual rate increases through January 1st, 2019. There are no amendments.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Tom Ballmer, Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, and with me today is Judge Jody Mooney, Lane County Circuit Court Judge and President of the Oregon Circuit Court Judges Association, and Representative Davis. We're here to testify in support of House Bill 4145, which I introduced, to schedule a series of salary increases and establish appropriate salary levels for state judges. And I'd like to thank the members of this committee who agreed to co-sponsor this bill. House rules, as you may know, precluded us from adding these names as co-sponsors of the bill on the bill itself, but I deeply appreciate the expression of support. And we'll talk to you about other ways you can assist us. The bill does three things, as committee counsel stated. It codifies the judicial salaries that we have now following the December 1st, 2015 cost of living adjustment, the first cost of living adjustment that we've received. And again, I deeply appreciate the legislature passing a COLA mechanism in the last session. It's really an important provision to limit the erosion of salaries due to inflation, and it'll be increasingly important over time. The bill also sets out, as the state policy on judicial compensation, the methodology used by the Public Officials Compensation Commission in 2008 That was the last time that statutory commission met. The POCC, which was the only objective review of elected official salaries in Oregon, determined that Oregon judicial salaries should be set at the median salary paid to judges in comparable positions in the 13 western states that the commission felt were comparable to Oregon. And then finally, the bill schedules four salary increases between 2016 and 2019 that would bring judicial salaries to that level using national information from July 1, 2015. I know that these increases might look large or seem ambitious. The important thing to me is that they would put our judges on a path to the POCC median over a reasonable period of time. That's really my goal here. There's never been a good time, frankly, to raise judicial salaries, and I've already heard that about this session, and I've heard that about next session, and if we wait for the best time, we might be waiting forever. And I don't really want to do that. In the meantime, I really want our bench, which has a lot of baby boomers on it, frankly, to know that there are things they can look forward to over time and to keep those folks on the bench. We frankly have a number of judges who are in their mid-50s, early 60s, who are considering leaving the bench. We'd like to keep those folks on. And having a schedule of increases over time in statute now, as proposed by House Bill 4145, would give our judges some certainty as they look at how much time they'll remain on the bench, instead of wondering whether this year or next or the year after might bring a raise while they look at professional opportunities off the bench and fall further and further behind their peers in other states, and more importantly, behind comparable public sector legal jobs in Oregon. And similarly, a schedule of increases means that as we recruit lawyers to the bench, they'll know that Oregon is serious about paying a salary that will help recruit the best lawyers at the height of their careers. You know, we're never going to match the salaries of the big Portland law firms, and we don't really need to in order to attract and recruit and retain highly qualified lawyers. But the fact is, the call of public service by itself is not really sufficient to consistently recruit high-quality lawyers, especially those with a civil law or a family law background. And especially when they have kids to put through college or are the primary or the only wage earner in their family. And I think Judge Mooney will have some other some information on that when she speaks. So in closing, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, last year when I appeared before this committee with my request, I was struck by Representative Post's comment. He expressed some shock and dismay that the Chief Justice would have to come hat in hand to the legislature for a pay increase. And Mr. Chair and Representative Post, I am back again with the same request. Please put a series of increases into statute now so we can maintain the excellent bench that Oregonians now have, that they could want to have in the future, and that they deserve. So thank you very much, and I'll answer any questions when the time comes.
Okay, thank you. Why don't you go ahead and we'll ask if any questions from the panel, sir.
All right, well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Jody Mooney. I'm a Lane County Circuit Court judge, and I'm this year's president of the Oregon Circuit Court Judges Association, here to speak in support of 4145 and to urge you to pass the bill out of committee with a positive recommendation. Last year, this committee supported our requests for salary increase and COLA. We received the COLA, and we're very thankful for that. We didn't get the increase, and so we're back again this year asking for that. The COLA is very important and meaningful to us, but even with that, we're still among the worst paid judges in the country. As Oregon's trial court judges, we serve people from all walks of life in every county in the state, with and without lawyers, frequently through language interpreters, and most often at very critical points in the parties in the people's lives. We make child custody decisions. There is almost never a day that goes by that I'm not asked to make an emergent custody decision when there's an allegation that a child is in immediate danger. We make the hard calls on landlord-tenant disputes and foreclosure cases. We preside over small claims cases, and we preside over complex medical malpractice cases. We decide whether to issue restraining orders in the moment just about every day that we go to the office. We review police officers' probable cause determinations, and we sign search warrants around the clock, sort of the work of the trial court judge. We hear the heartrending stories of victims at the time of sentencing, and we listen to those, and we make sentencing decisions that impact lots of people for a long time. To do all this, we do need judges who have a wide range of experience. That wide range of experience ensures subject matter competency, and that's very important. We also need judges with enough experience to command the level of respect that's necessary to run a courtroom and to get the job done. The decision to take one's dispute to court rather than to the streets depends upon a strong and intelligent judicial branch. HB 4145 will reinforce the importance of the work of Oregon's judges, and in turn that will enhance our ability to be effective as judges. The salary increases that are reflected in the bill offer compensation levels that will be sufficient to recruit the best lawyers in Oregon to do this work without having to make an undue sacrifice of financial security. More than 100 lawyers in the Department of Justice earn more than the trial judges they appear before. Many of us believe that this pay disparity has an impact on the dynamics in the courtroom. And while it's an impact that is difficult to define, it is apparent. You know it when you see it. My own son asked me recently why I had agreed to take a pay cut when I took this position on the Lane County bench. And, you know, the question was followed by, is it just not as important? Is it less demanding? And, of course, the answer to that was no, but the salary level didn't really support the conclusion and the answer that I gave him. And, of course, the conversation was in the context of how are we going to pay for college now that he's getting ready to embark on that. I wanted to just conclude in the process of keeping the circuit court judges and the appellate court judges in the state of Oregon aware of our activities here today in this bill. I sent some information out, and I received a note back from one of our long-term judges, and out of respect for that judge's privacy, I'm not going to mention the name, but it was an unsolicited email, and it was an illustration of what we're facing. And I received this note yesterday indicating that she was approaching the beginning of her 20th year with the circuit court and had decided it would be her last. At age 60, I felt I should retire and try my hand as a mediator where I could make more money before I really retire. If the requested raises are approved, I plan to stay and continue doing the work that I have loved doing for the past two decades. And I give that to you as an example of kind of what we're facing here, and ask that that you do whatever is in your power to help us get the pay level up to a point where we don't have to make decisions at the time of retirement about whether to continue to do the work we do and do it well, or join the mediation industry, if you will. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. I'm State Representative John Davis from House District 26, the fight in 26. It's wonderful to be here, and it's also wonderful to see the tremendous support we're receiving from folks across the state and the country for judicial compensation. I think it's safe to say we've never had such a strong showing. So, thank you, all of you.
You like our T-shirts, that's what I like.
It's also evident that we have strong support among the legislature, and I'm really here just as a reminder to each of you as committee members of a letter that's been submitted into the record and that many of you have signed. In fact, 46 members of the House and Senate have signed this letter in support of the principles behind House Bill 4145 and the need for a adequately and fairly compensated judiciary. This issue became important to me as I jumped into the legislative process, and it became evident the imbalance of power among the three branches of government in the state of Oregon, that we've continually enlarged the executive and administrative branches of the state over the last 30 years, and we have not invested in our judicial branch, and we have not invested in our legislative branch. I'm speaking to the judicial branch at this point. This is one step we can take among many. We've enlarged the Court of Appeals recently by adding a panel. We have increased the COLA for judges, but we are simply still at the bottom among the states, and among comparable states in particular, for our compensation for our judges in the third co-equal branch of our government, who, A, deserve to be paid what they're worth for the incredibly difficult job and time-consuming job they are doing, but also as a way to continue to recruit qualified public servants into the judiciary. I just will remind you of the second paragraph of the letter that, depending on how you count, whether or not you incorporate the cost of living for the particular state in question, Oregon ranks between 44th and 50th in the country for our compensation of our judges. Support for this bill is a reasonable and incremental step to bring some constitutional parity, I think, between our three branches of government. Thank you for your support.
Thank you. Any questions from the panel? Representative Post.
I'll be really brief. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chief Justice, I can't believe you remembered that. Two, I was actually going to say it again today. So, anyway, I can't believe we're having to actually do this, and I'm looking forward to. I hope that this moves forward again, and it's needed. Of course, I'm going to go with Representative Davis as well, and you know, go out there and on a limb and say, you know, legislators, no, but you guys first. and I really am. I am excited that we were able to hear this again. I just wanted you to know that. It's really important.
Thank you.
Springer, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I first started looking at this issue, I asked myself why. I always do that, why. And I was meeting with one of my local circuit court judges who he said, let me preface my comments by I won't benefit from this. I'm retiring. And he asked me one simple question that I think we should all ask ourselves. He goes, when attorneys can make a lot of money in practice, whatever a lot is, he said, what kind of judge do you want? And I think that that's the relevant question here. What kind of judge do we want?
Hey, thank you very much. Next to call Arthur Towers and Drake Hood.
For the record, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I've submitted written testimony. Our organization supports this legislation. I have several things to say, but in deference and out of respect to the folks in the audience who have come a long way to testify, I'll conclude my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Chair Barker. My name is Drake Hood. I represent the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel, sort of the counterpart group, and I will keep my remarks very brief. I'll submit some written remarks, but I'd just like to say this. We represent I represent about 700 members of our organization. We are not a criminal defense organization, but we represent businesses and people throughout the state of Oregon involved in civil litigation, cases that involve contracts with businesses, cases that involve tort claims against individuals and businesses. We are in support of HB 4145 and ask that you pass it out of committee favorably.
Any questions for this? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Move to a work session on House Bill 4145.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4145 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
We have a motion to move the bill to the floor.
Yes, I need to comment.
Okay, please.
I feel that I have a conflict of interest in this. Not a formal conflict of interest because the circuit court judges is a class of about 200, something under 200, but my son is one of them. And under House rules, I want to declare a potential conflict of interest and point out to the audience that in normal circumstances, I would recuse myself from a vote under House rules. I'm forced to vote even with a conflict of interest, so I will be voting.
We don't allow people to just be present. I think you have to vote. So any further discussion? Are there any objections? So order bill pass.
Please note my comment on the record.
Here, okay, it goes down to Ways and Means. Okay. Next, open a public hearing on House Bill 4075.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 4075 is one of the House Judiciary bills for this session. As you might recall, in 2014, we created the Oregon Task Force on School Safety, and you've heard some presentations from this group. One of their recommendations is to establish and fund a statewide tip line for reports of threats to student safety. House Bill 4075 establishes that statewide tip line and appropriates approximately $1 million for the implementation of the line. Not approximate, it does appropriate $1 million. The line must receive telephone calls, text messages, and electronic messages through the internet, and it develops rules on processing those calls, including how to protect the identity of the caller while enabling return contacts. Now, there are a variety of amendments in place on this bill, so we are not ready to move it today. We will be working further on the amendments, so you can expect to see it early next week with additional details.
Thank you. Sheriff Roberts and Captain Worthy. And Marge Easley, please. Please go ahead, Sheriff.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Craig Roberts, Sheriff of Clackamas County. I'm appearing today as the chair of the Oregon Task Force on School Safety, and also here on behalf of co-chair Superintendent Rich Evans is Captain Tom Worthy with Oregon State Police. So one of the things that we're here today to talk about is House Bill 4075. And last fall, the task force issued its report to the legislature identifying several critical areas for improving safety in our Oregon schools. Recommendations were made in the short term, establishing and funding a statewide tip line is our first priority. That recommendation is now House Bill 4075, a statewide tip line that will allow students, families, and others to report potential threats, bullying, self-harm, and other concerns. Michigan and Colorado have student tip lines, and we know from their experience that students will use the tip lines, and most importantly, that this will save lives. In addition to the tip line, the task force is asking for your support to extend the work of the task force past its 2017 sunset. We're seeking an extension to September of 2019, and we still have a great deal of work to accomplish, such as establishing and funding a statewide student threat assessment system that we're working on, a statewide school floor plan database. And finally, over the past 18 months, the task force has become increasingly aware that we are missing two key stakeholders at the table to inform and help direct our work. We need the Oregon Department of Education and the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs at the table with us. We ask for your support in adding these additional task force members. And in closing, I just want to acknowledge really the tireless effort and engagement of my fellow task force members and the leadership of Superintendent Rich Evans. Obviously, Captain Tom Worthy has been working tremendous hours on this project. And a special thanks, I want to just go through and mention our task force members. And that is Senator Betsy Johnson, Representative Jeff Barker, Heidi Moed, Lindsey Capps, Chief Jeff Spaulding with the Beaverton Police Department, Eric Gablix, Susan Graves, Matt Utterback, Ted Coons, Peggy Holstead, and Dr. Dave Novotny. And really a special thanks to each one of you for your support in helping us move this forward. And really, from the bottom of my heart, I have to tell you, I can't say how much that I believe this will save lives of our students in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Over to Ms. Captain.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker. My name is Tom Worthy. I'm a captain with the Oregon State Police. And rather than repeat what Sheriff Roberts has already so eloquently said to the committee, I would just like to add that the Oregon State Police is in lockstep with our partners at local police departments and sheriff's departments, as well as those in education and ultimately public health in this important endeavor. School safety tip line, as a parent of children in Oregon public schools, seems like a reasonable investment, a place where they can go to make a safe and a confidential report about bullying, threats of violence, any threat to the school. Therefore, in partnership with the Sheriff's Department, we would just like to say thank you to the committee for your leadership in this issue.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marge Easley. I'm with the League of Women Voters of Oregon, And this will be brief. I just wanted to express our appreciation for the work of this of the Oregon School Safety Task Force to make our schools safer places for our children to be. We are especially appreciative of the fact that you are considering continuing the work of the committee, and we applaud that there will be more members of the committee possibly added. We are happy to see that there are many forms of transmission, including telephone, text, and electronic format through the internet. And so I just wanted to express our appreciation. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any question for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ann Kirkwood, Cheryl Ramirez, and Tricia Smith.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent the 20,000 classified school employees working in Oregon Head Start's K-12 schools, ESDs, and community colleges, and we are very pleased that you are hearing and hopefully considering moving House Bill 4075. One of those 20,000 souls is our member Sue Graves, who serves on the task force that created the report you have before you and the bill. Sue has for 15 years led a threat assessment team in Lincoln County. She is an expert that goes all over the country and all over the state advising other schools how to set up threat assessment teams so that they can evaluate threats as they become aware of them and determine how serious they are and what the appropriate action is. The task force gave you four recommendations. Two of those recommendations deal with how to deal what law enforcement and school personnel need during the time of an active shooting. And two of those recommendations are meant to help prevent those shooting events. One is the tip line and the other is the threat assessment teams, a statewide system of threat assessment teams. We strongly support House Bill 4075 with the amendments that continue the task force and expand it with the Department of Education and mental health professionals on board, because that is where we will create that statewide system of threat assessment teams that can then receive the tips that come from that tip line and deal with them appropriately and hopefully prevent the next and the next and the next tragedy from occurring. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, I'm Ann Kirkwood. I'm the Suicide Intervention and Prevention Coordinator for the Oregon Health Authority Children's Unit. OHA is neutral on bills, including this one, but is supportive of the underlying goals of House Bill 4075 to ensure reporting of threats to students and establishes a student safety tip line. The bill recognizes that research shows that a high percentage of threats to self or others are known by peers in advance of an event. Threat assessment and response is a highly specialized and high-risk procedure requiring willing, capable, and competent partners who have the capacity to respond in an urgent, very urgent manner. Law enforcement and schools need to rely on mental health and substance abuse resources in their communities in order to respond effectively and appropriately. Local partnerships and protocols for response should be in place before calls begin coming into the tip line. This is a window of opportunity for Oregon to intervene in the life of high-risk students, both as a law enforcement and school issue, and as a matter of mental and emotional well-being of our students. In order for a tip line to respond appropriately to calls for substance use concerns, mental health crises, and suicide risk, it will be important to establish a state framework to guide local protocols for involving not only law enforcement and schools, but other community partners, including community mental health and substance abuse, crisis response and treatment programs, and juvenile departments. For example, the Colorado Safe to Tell tip line experiences a large number of calls relating to suicide, substance abuse, depression, and self-injury. In the 2014-15 academic year, there were 1,514 of the 3,467 calls to Safe to Tell for suicide, substance abuse, depression, and self-injury, all of which would benefit from a behavioral health response. Mental health response by local and county providers may be the most appropriate intervention, in fact, for the person who poses a threat to self or others, but also for the grief, trauma, and elevated suicide risk experienced by the victim and their families. We've submitted to the committee council some suggestions for potential amendments to the legislation, and these suggestions cover five general topics. First, we suggest addition of a section to direct the Oregon State Police to collaborate with appropriate behavioral health stakeholders in state, county, and local government and community partners to increase the capacity, capability, and appropriateness of response. Second, to improve effectiveness of response, we suggest adoption of state rules as an overall framework to guide development of local protocols to coordinate law enforcement and school response with local behavioral health providers and appropriate community-based threat assessment teams. Third, we suggest expanding the scope to reach students in vocational, colleges and universities, and perhaps private schools. Our last two recommendations, we believe, are addressed in the Dash 2 amendments, but I'd like to provide them to you anyway. Overall, student safety would benefit from coordinating the tip line with the knowledge and skills that are currently evident in our Oregon crisis lines, hotlines, and warm lines. We also recommend that you consider expanding the legislation to include threats outside of schools or not on school property to anywhere in the community, as well as threats to potentially non-students, in order to capture threats in public places such as movie theaters, workplaces, or other public gathering places. That concludes my testimony. Thank you very much for the opportunity, and I'm glad to respond to questions.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I am Cheryl Ramirez. I'm the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, and I'm here on behalf of the 32 community mental health programs across the state to express our support for House Bill 4075. I would echo Ann's points. We're in alignment with Oregon Health Authority's comments on this. I just want to emphasize a couple of Ann's points. One is, before the tip line goes live, it's really important to have multi-systemic collaboration, especially between education, law enforcement, and the mental health systems, both at the state and the local level. And it will be important to address the local infrastructure, the policies and protocols that need to be developed through this tip line. Very important to coordinate with existing crisis systems. You may know that there is a county-based crisis system in Oregon. It's already established, and they're going to be your experts on the ground for mental health crises. And, of course, as Ann mentioned, there are crisis and warm lines. As she also mentioned in the Colorado study, a little less than half of the calls resulted in referrals to mental health and substance use disorder treatment. And so it would be really important to make sure that those services are well resourced in each of our communities. I see the tip line really as a screening and referral tool. The person answering the phone will have to determine the appropriate route for the individual who the caller is calling about, and possibly the caller himself or herself. Maybe that person was bullied. So it will be important for this person answering the phone, the screener, to have sufficient resources both in diverting that person to a justice route or to the mental health route. So I just want to really emphasize that. I'm really happy to participate in the task force. I just barely saw the dash one and dash two amendments. I did a really cursory review. So we'd like to look at it a little more carefully, and we'd love to provide comments. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, and I appreciate input that's been coming in. So we have the call center will have to be highly trained people, and they also have to highly train contact at the school so that we get the right sources to help whoever's calling. So any questions from the panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony today. As we said, we're not ready to move it today, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4075. Okay. And open public hearing on House Bill 4147.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, this bill comes to you from Representative Williamson. In order to purchase or transfer a firearm, a background check is required. This background check is required to be completed through the Oregon State Police, which provides a unique approval number for qualified sales or transfers, or will alert a seller or a dealer that the individual is disqualified from taking possession of the firearm. In some cases, the department's not able to make that determination. And in the case of a sale through a gun dealer, if the department is unable to verify the purchaser is qualified or disqualified by the end of the dealer's next business day, the dealer may deliver the handgun to the purchaser. House Bill 4147 prohibits a dealer from transferring a handgun to a purchaser until the dealer has received a unique approval number from the department. It also prohibits an individual from transferring a firearm to another if the department is unable to make that determination, and it requires the department to notify local law enforcement when a person who is disqualified from possessing a firearm has attempted a purchase.
Thank you. The first panel is Representative Williamson, Reverend Risher, and Paul Kemp. On deck, Terry McAllister, Samuel McAllister, and Ted Campbell.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Williamson, and I'm the House District 36 State Representative. I want to first thank you all for holding this hearing today, and I want to thank everyone who signed up to testify today, some traveling great distances to share very painful and tragic stories. Despite how fractious these kinds of policy discussions can become, I think we can all agree that we share the goal of limiting gun violence in our communities. Too often, we've seen the horrific carnage caused by mass shootings and attacks in our schools and in our houses of worship. And although they go less reported by the media, we know of the countless women who have been hurt or killed by abusive partners armed with a firearm. With the broad support of the public, we've made progress in trying to solve this crisis. We've taken steps towards ensuring that dangerous individuals, violent criminals, and domestic abusers don't have easy access to firearms that can be used to do harm. But before I talk about the specifics of the bill, I want to introduce to the committee Reverend Sharon Risher. I'm honored to have her here to share her tragic story, and I'll talk more about the details of the bill after the Reverend and Mr. Kemp testify.
Judicial Committee members, thank you for the opportunity to provide input for this most important hearing. As you know, my name is Sharon Risher, and I'm here today because my mother, Mrs. Ethel Lance, and two cousins, Susie Jackson and Tywanza Sanders, were killed along with six others in the Emmanuel AME shooting on June 17th, this past summer in Charleston, South Carolina. They were killed in a place of worship, a sacred place where we should all feel safe, by a dangerous man who was able to buy a gun because of a flaw in our background check systems. I am here today to share my story with you and ask you all to support House Bill 4147. You have the power to prevent a similar act of violence here in Oregon. My mother, Mrs. Ethel Lance, was a wonderful woman. I think we all can agree that our mothers are wonderful people. My mother was a woman of faith, a woman whose values I aspire to every day. Nothing could have prepared me for that day and for the phone call when I discovered that members of my family had been shot and killed in a church we've been attending and praying in for generations. I have spent my life working as an ER trauma chaplain, but nothing in my line of work prepared me for the shock, pain, and emptiness I felt after having my family members shot and killed in an act of senseless gun violence. In the days after my mother's death, nothing made sense. After such an act of vicious hatred, I knelt in prayer more than I ever have in my life, because I was sure that God had unleashed a burden on me that I couldn't handle. I searched my heart for answers that I thought would never come. That pain was compounded by the shock when I learned that because of a flaw in our background check systems, a dangerous man was able to buy a gun and shoot 9 beautiful people with it. The shooter was prohibited from buying firearms because of his drug arrest record and would have failed a background check. But he was able to buy a gun because under federal law, gun sales, he can proceed after 3 business days. Even if background check operators have not confirmed, the buyer is legally allowed to have guns. The gun dealer in this case decided to proceed with the sale, even though the background check was not complete. The consequences of that decision are devastating, and we cannot accept this as a status quo. Too many Americans and Oregonians have discovered that all it takes is one gun in the hands of a dangerous person to commit mass murder. But there are steps we could take to prevent dangerous people from buying guns. Background checks work. Completed background checks have blocked more than 2 million sales to dangerous people who are prohibited from owning guns. And this system has saved countless lives. Oregon took one huge step last year by closing the private sale loophole. I applaud you for your leadership. Now, we must stand up once again and ensure that the background check system is as strong as it can be. House Bill 4147 will give law enforcement the ability to make sure criminals don't buy guns because the clock runs out. I think about my mother and my cousins and every person that was killed in that church. Every day, I think about what we can do as a society to prevent other families from receiving the heart-wrenching phone call that their loved one has been taken from them forever because of a horrific and preventable act of violence. You can do something, and that is vote yes on House Bill 4147. Thank you for the opportunity to address you this day.
Thank you very much for coming out, and we appreciate your hard testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Kemp?
Yeah. Hi. My name is Paul Kemp. Thank you, Chairman Barker and the other committee members, for this opportunity to speak before you and share my story today. I'm here to speak on behalf of my sister Carla and her late husband Steve Forsyth, who was murdered with a shot to the back of the head at the Clackamas Town Center Mall on December 11, 2012. This is not my first time testifying here in Oregon State Capitol. I testified in support of SB 941, a bill that closed the private sale loophole. I am a gun owner, a hunter, and a proud to be an Oregonian when the legislature did the right thing and passed gun violence prevention legislation that we know will prevent dangerous people from getting guns. You will now have the chance to further strengthen the background check system and help save lives by passing HB 4147. In Oregon, background checks are now required on all gun sales. This is a huge step forward for public safety. We know that in states with background checks on unlicensed sales, there are 46% fewer women shot to death by intimate partners, and 48% fewer law enforcement officers are killed with handguns. But there are additional steps you can take to make the background check system even stronger. These steps we must take are twofold. First, we must ensure that in the cases where dangerous people try to break the law and buy guns but are denied because they failed a background check, local law enforcement is alerted so they can follow up to investigate and make an arrest. The proposed legislation would require the state police to alert local law enforcement when a prohibited person tries and fails to buy a gun. Providing law enforcement with the information to arrest dangerous people before they can get a gun somewhere else. Secondly, we must close what's called the Charleston loophole, which allows a gun sale to proceed after 3 business days, even if the background check is incomplete. It's exactly how the Charleston shooter got his gun and used it to take the lives of 9 innocent churchgoers this past summer. As I mentioned, I'm a gun owner and hunter. I've had background checks every time I purchased a gun. I know that background checks are quick and easy. But actually, I saw a man's background check came back as pending while I was purchasing a handgun for myself at a gun dealer in Beaverton. I overheard the conversation between the gun dealer and the buyer. When the background check came back pending, the gun dealer told the buyer that his background check was still being completed and that he would not be able to sell him the gun until it was complete. I can only hope that if the man came back to the store after 3 days, the dealer would have continued to act responsibly and not sold him the gun. I also know in the conversations in the store that man had several other guns already at home. But at that point, if the dealer wanted to, he could sell the gun, even though Oregon State Police were still determining whether the man was a felon, a domestic abuser, or other dangerous person. We can hope that gun dealers will be responsible. We know that many, including Walmart, do the right thing and wait for the background checks to come back finished before selling a gun. However, we also know that without a law on the books, some gun dealers will proceed with the sale even if the background check is incomplete. We know that because of stories like Reverend Risher's, who I had the honor to meet last fall, shortly after the Charleston shooting, and again today. Her mother and 8 other Americans might still be alive today if this flaw in the background checks system that allows gun sales to proceed with incomplete background checks had been in place. The proposed legislation in HB 4147 would fix this deadly flaw. Reverend Risher's tragic story reminds me too much of my own. Like the Reverend's mother, my brother-in-law's was a man who left a huge imprint on the world and whose legacy and memories live on every day. Steve was a good man, a loving husband, a caring dad who made time to coach basketball and football. My lasting memory of Steve was a 16th birthday celebration for my son. That birthday celebration was special, and when we look back at the photos, we felt very lucky because Steve was murdered 2 days later. Because of a dangerous man with a gun, Steve, like too many other Americans, was murdered. My sister Carla, her son Alex, and daughter Katie have to live with Steve's senseless murder forever, a lot longer than 3 days. We know there's no one thing you can do to prevent every act of gun violence, but you have the power to prevent more tragedy and save lives. I strongly urge you to support House Bill 4147. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, you can see why I'm honored to be sitting on this panel with these two people who have suffered such tragedy in their families. We know that Oregonians overwhelmingly support criminal background checks for all gun sales, and the law of the state of Oregon reflects that. On paper, we require that all potential gun buyers pass a criminal background check before they can purchase a firearm. Except in practice, we have a large loophole that allows for anyone to purchase a gun, even if they have a violent criminal background. I want to share with you just a few numbers from the Oregon State Police to help put this bill in perspective. In 2015, the Oregon State Police conducted more than 250,000 background checks for gun sales. 96.8% of those checks were completed within 5 minutes. Now, that's the amount of time it takes for the actual check. If there's a queue in progress, the wait time can be longer. And this is an issue when there's a large number of checks going through, so during the holiday season or hunting season. And it's also a resource issue with the Oregon State Police. And I'm working with the State Police to address their resource needs to speed up the process for background checks for everyone. The other 3.22% of background checks in 2015 went into this pending file, meaning that they've been flagged for further review to determine if the buyer is eligible to own a gun. An example of why a file would be flagged would be if someone had a restraining order for domestic violence in a different state, or had been convicted of a domestic violence crime in another state that would make them ineligible to own a gun in Oregon, but it's not clear by the record that crime on its face was a domestic violence crime. This can be a labor-intensive process because someone has to physically go pull the file in that courthouse in another state to read the case to decide whether or not it's a domestic violence case that would be prohibited, the person would be prohibited from owning a gun in Oregon. As you've heard, under current law, if this process takes longer than 3 days, the seller has the discretion to sell the gun anyway. A further look into these numbers, I believe, is alarming. The denial rate for all background checks is 0.73%. So that's less than 1%. But the denial rate for those who go into a pending status is 5%. In other words, the background checks that go into the pending status are 5 times more likely to be ultimately show that the buyer has something in their background that prohibits them from owning a gun. If you do the math, in Oregon, this adds up to hundreds of people who can potentially and legally purchase a firearm, even though under Oregon law they're prohibited from owning one. I know that most responsible gun dealers wait until the background check is complete, but not everyone does. We've heard in this committee many times that we need to do more to go after the bad guys who try to buy guns when they shouldn't. And this bill gives local law enforcement the ability to do just that. We owe it to our communities to pass common sense gun laws that keep them safe, and closing this loophole is the right thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you, panel. I really appreciate your testimony. Next is Terry McAllister, Samuel McAllister, and Ted Campbell. On deck is Kimberly Dixon, Charlie McKenna, and Sandra McDonald. You'll be able to see the timer behind us, and so hopefully we can keep it in there so get as many people as possible to testify today. Thank you. Just remember to introduce yourself by name for the record. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Chair members, my name is Ted Campbell. I'm an FFL dealer. I live both in Lapine and in Salem. And I want to address this bill because, first of all, the thumbprints, few states require them. It's no problem in Oregon, but using Oregon's thumbprint card is ridiculous. As you notice in the handout, the back of the 4473 has a place where we can just put them. And Oregon's says they're going to save paper, so why waste that and not use this. Also, in the bill, it says it has to take thumbprints, but we've run into people without thumbs, so what do we do? The bill is really kind of ridiculous because it doesn't cover the things that needs to be covered. They keep talking about the phone number in the bill. It doesn't say anything about the internet that almost all the dealers are using now. So do we not use that anymore, which is a speedier way of doing the background check? So the bill does not cover that at all. The 30-minute rule, it says we can, if they don't get you an answer in 30 minutes, it goes in a delay status. Is that 30 minutes from when we enter it or 30 minutes from when you start reviewing it? It does not define that either. If a person is delayed, the state police their computer should generate a letter to the individual explaining why. Because 90% of the time, it's because the court, when the person has finished his diversion or his restitution or anything, has not completed the record so that he's cleared. So they have to go to this, as you just heard, and pull these records. A lot of the delay is on the court side by not following up and closing this. If it takes more than 30 minutes, I'm sorry. Sometimes, like on Black Friday, it's taken as long as 7 hours to get a response because there's over 150 to 500 people in the queue. This bill should be thrown out and written by people that understand gun sales that are in the state legislature and bring in some experts that know this, because most of the gun dealers want to follow the rules, but they're left so many loopholes that no matter what, they're going to be guilty of doing something wrong. I'd also like to thank Mr. Bloomberg for the man has all kinds of armed barley guards and lives in New York for sending people out here to enrich our economy, but he doesn't understand how the people on the West Coast live. Anyway, that is all. If you have any questions.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming down.
Defer to you.
My name is Terry McAllister. I'm from Mapleton, Oregon. The Constitution of the State of Oregon says in Article 1, Section 27, the people shall have the right to bear arms for the defense of themselves. The right to keep and bear arms is a fundamental right. It is also enumerated in the Bill of Rights of the Constitution of the United States. And the Bill of Rights also states, nor shall any person be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The bill before us, HB 4147, would permit the Oregon State Police to deny the right of the people to bear arms indefinitely and without due process. The current law regarding the purchase of firearms rightly puts the burden of proof on the state to show that a person is prohibited from purchasing a firearm. The current law says that the state has one business day to find a statutory reason for denying a firearms purchase. This burden should be on the state. It is not possible for the people to prove they have not committed a crime that would put them in the category of prohibited persons. It's not possible to prove a negative. Because firearms ownership is such an important and fundamental right, and because the burden of proof should always be on the state to prove guilt rather than on the people to prove innocence, the current law regarding firearms purchases should not be changed in order to permit the Oregon State Police to delay firearms purchases for an unlimited period of time. That would violate both the Oregon Constitution and the Constitution of the United States and put those people who are at risk of imminent violence in a position of helplessness. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Sam McAllister, and I reside in Mapleton, Oregon also. I am a federally licensed firearms dealer operating in the state of Oregon. And, of course, I am opposed to this bill. Now, the reasoning behind this bill I consider quite false. In more than 7 years, I've yet to see a denial on a delay that lasted over an hour. I have had no delays that lasted over an hour that were denied later. They were all approved, even 4 months later. And I've even heard of ones that were 6 months. Now, legislators and supporters of this bill claim that the state police are unable to do background checks within the time limit allowed by law. This is not a failure of law, but a failure of the state. We are told the background check system is having budgetary issues, don't have enough people, Again, the state legislature enacted the background check law, predictably without knowing how much it would cost. This is a failure of the state legislature for which the citizens of Oregon should not have to pay. The solution is to turn over the background checks to the FBI and save the state time and money in this headache. This bill allows for no independently verifiable standards by which we can judge the state in compliance with the law. Without a clear standard for state agent malfeasance as time limits are accomplished, the state is completely unaccountable. This bill effectively puts all background checks within the discretion of state agents whom we are expected to trust. And I'm sorry, but ask any Native American how well we can trust promises of the government. Because this law effectively causes all firearms transfers to be at the discretion of the state, it is in clear violation of the Second Amendment, as it is a de facto ban on firearms transfers in established case law and Supreme Court laws or cases. Even the most narrow and limited interpretation of the Second Amendment would have to conclude that this is a de facto ban. Now, I have a little bit of time left over, and I would like to say, because I prepared for 2 minutes, very shortly, when our legislators do not care about the law that gives them the power to legislate, why would anyone give any kind of credence to laws that are put forth when the legislature is not following the law? Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next up, Kimberly Dixon, Charlie McKenna, and Sarah McDonald. On deck, Kevin Sterrett, Roger Beyer, and Ronnie Daniels. Please go ahead and in the order, remember to identify yourself for the record by name.
Kimberly Dixon.
Go ahead. You can just go ahead and talk.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. I'm Kimberly Dixon, and I'm from Enough is Enough, PDX, in Portland, Oregon, where we work on gun violence issues, supporting the trauma that families go through, partnering with state agencies, businesses, and such. And my nexus to HB 4147 is my family has fallen victim to violence, and more specifically, gun violence. My son, Andreas Dixon, was killed June 9, 2013 in Gresham, Oregon. Andreas is affectionately known as Mike Coconut. He was a little hard knock on the outside, but sweet on the inside. He was just 21. He left behind 9 other sisters and brothers, grandparents, uncles, aunts, and a host of nieces and nephews. Every day is a new opportunity for us all to figure out this new normal of him no longer being here, of him leaving outside of the normal life cycle. I may not be fully versed in all of the bills that you may see coming and going through legislature, but what I am well versed in is what losing a family member too soon and out of life cycle is like. I am well versed in the grief process of learning how to pick through the pieces of your life, of what was and what is, and still find purpose in it. I am well versed in having something no one else wants, which is a heart ripped wide open. I am well versed in having not all the answers to the eyes that look at me and ask why. As a family, we have cried silently to ourselves, and we outwardly remember him, Andreas, Prince, Keakamai, with joy in our hearts. I don't know if any of you have ever lost a child. I can assure you that I wish upon no one, under any circumstances, that burden. You can't change a thing about my grief, but you could do something to prevent others from this experience. And let me be clear, I fully support my Second Amendment rights, fully support. And I don't think that this bill in any way, shape, or form interrupts those rights. But we must be sensible. We must have gun sense. And that is a responsibility that you have. You can empower us all, business, citizens, and law enforcement, while maintaining Second Amendment rights. Let me provide the impetus for you to do something, if not, in fact, the right thing, which is HB 4147. Please vote yes. Please vote for someone to live.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the Judiciary Committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify in favor of House Bill 4147. My name is Charlie McKenna. I live in Eugene. I'm the local lead for the Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America in Eugene, and even though it says that, I'm really not a mother. I, along with many other Oregonians, worked with you and the governor to pass the comprehensive background check bill last session. That was a tremendous accomplishment for the state of Oregon, and we know that law is going to save lives. We also know that that law can be made stronger by passing this bill. It will close that loophole that we've heard about in testimony before you today. So I want to say that I spent a lot of time last year working, trying to get that law passed by lobbying you and also by spending a lot of time in conversation with Oregonians. I talked to probably close to 1,000 Oregonians over the last year, and almost none of them, with the exception of one or two convicted felons, had any disagreement with the fact that there are people that should not own firearms. There's almost universal agreement that there are certain people that shouldn't have guns. This law, this bill, if it's passed into law, would help further restrict those people that almost everyone agrees shouldn't have guns from being able to legally purchase guns. The gun lobby likes to say guns don't kill people, people kill people, and they're absolutely right. This law, this bill, is not about guns. It's about people. It's about restricting people that shouldn't have access to guns from getting access to guns legally. So I think that that's the important part of this. We heard about the Charleston loophole, the very compelling testimony from a woman whose family was murdered by someone who was able to obtain their gun through that loophole. This will give us an effort to make sure that never happens in Oregon, which I think is extremely important. Our state is all too familiar with mass gun violence, and this is a way we can try to help reduce the likelihood of that in the future. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify for you today.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I am Sarah Finger McDonald. I'm from Corvallis, and I'm also a volunteer with Moms Demand Action. I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 4147. Last Sunday, I was at a town hall meeting in Corvallis, and at that meeting, Representative Olson spoke about the purpose of the short legislative session. He talked about it as an opportunity to look at our laws and improve on bills passed in previous sessions. It's exactly why I'm pleased to see HB 4147 introduced this session. This bill would improve Oregon's background check system. It will improve and build on Oregon's important gun safety law that went into effect in August. It will give local law enforcement the information they need to arrest dangerous people who've tried to purchase a gun so that we as a state can do a better job enforcing our laws. This bill will also ensure that background checks are actually completed. I teach at a university. I know the difference between a pass and an incomplete. Students don't pass my class if their work is not complete. Right now, with background checks in Oregon, an incomplete is in effect a pass. If work of determining if a person is eligible to buy a gun is not able to be finished in 3 days, we'll let them purchase that gun anyway. We give them a pass. Let's hold all our gun owners to the same standard and complete the work of our background checks before we decide who passes and who fails. After all, this is far more important than a college course. This could be life and death if an incomplete background check means domestic abusers or felons can buy guns. Please vote in favor of 4147. Please make sure a background check is completed before a gun can be purchased, and give local law enforcement the tools they need to enforce our background check law. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Kevin Sturt, Roger Beyer, and Ronnie Daniels. On deck is Carrie Selby, Rebecca Cohen, and Amy Wexler.
Members of the committee, Kevin Starrett for Oregon Firearms Federation. The Oregon State background check system does not work. The sponsor of this bill just told us that 95% of the people who are pended incorrectly. So clearly it's not working. Every day I hear from people who've been denied their rights with no justification, some of them for many months, some of them for up to 2 years. Efforts to resolve these issues are met with stonewalling, runarounds, and roadblocks. The attitude of the Oregon State Police ID unit is, we don't care, we don't have to. And now that the FBI has suspended investigations into, delays and denials, thousands of qualified people are just out of luck. I've shared with you in the exhibits some of the many emails that I've received from people who are victims of this mess. I have plenty more and lots of phone calls. I've also enclosed a screenshot of the background check interface used by my gun club to attempt to transfer. One of our members tried to buy a gun in November. He was delayed until January because he was known to us. The gun was delivered lawfully to him after 3 days. But it wasn't the gun he ordered, so he returned it. When the correct gun came in, they conducted another background check, which he passed immediately, even though he was still being delayed for the first gun. If you look at the screenshot, you'll see he's being delayed till January 12th. Well, that screenshot was taken on January 25th, so clearly this makes no sense. Only the state could develop a faulty system, force you to be subjected to it, and then punish you when it fails. And now you're considering making it worse. Even the sponsor of this bill publicly admits that the vast number of people who are delayed in error, although I think she greatly underestimates how many people that is. Based on her own comments, it's clear that she's not happy that anyone's able to acquire a firearm, so it's safe to say what this bill's about. The tiny and insufficient safeguards in the current law are not loopholes. Every right is not a loophole that needs to be closed. In fact, the parts of the law that 4147 will change are carefully considered elements to afford some small amount of protection to people who are being victimized by the faults of the current system. If 8,000 people were denied the right to vote because of a bureaucratic error on the part of the Elections Division, would you be satisfied if they were told they could vote in 6 months? This has nothing to do with stopping spree killers, most of whom successfully completed background checks. We have to stop perpetuating that myth. It's a bad idea, and it should be rejected.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the National Rifle Association of America. ORS 166-412 was first enacted in 1995 as an instant background check system, replacing a waiting period at that time was required for purchase of handguns. The safeguards in Section 3 of 166-412 was to protect the civil liberties of Oregonians. The legislature intentionally reserved this protection. It is not a loophole or a mistake. It was intentionally done. 4147 would make it virtually impossible to purchase a firearm if the state police simply chose to not respond to the request. We know that OSP would never do that, but that is no reassurance for those Oregonians who this very day are waiting in these pending requests. Section 2 of this bill was just enacted as Senate Bill 941 last year. The amendments to this statute now apply only to the private party transfers performed by gun dealers. The wording of it is very interesting when it speaks of whether a person is qualified or disqualified. The system is not set up to find qualified purchasers of guns, of firearms. It only is supposed to check for disqualified purchasers. So if the state police are out looking for qualified purchasers, I know of no such list that exists anywhere in the U.S. This could literally take forever because no one has such a list to find the qualified purchasers. They should be looking for a single disqualification. And when they find that single disqualification, the person is denied. So the statutes in Oregon, if that's the problem, if that's what's slowing down the unique system in Oregon, because they are out looking for for qualified purchasers, a list which does not exist, or if it's due to the increased volume created by Senate Bill 941 in last year's session, then Oregon should can or get rid of their unique background system and go back to the federal system, the National Instant Check System. It's free, it's available, and it's instant, and it works. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. My name is Ronnie Daniels. I'm just a private citizen, a flagger, drove 175 miles to come to this meeting. I live in Sheridan, Oregon, from work. I work down south. And make a long story short, I am appalled. First of all, my first question is, how come it's always got to be an emergency action? Under the Oregon Constitution, as a voter, as a citizen who has a clean record, I do not understand why everything got to be an emergency. Yes, there was a tragedy. We had, this past year, the worst series of murders in this whole country. All those places, for facts, it was in gun-free zone areas where you cannot carry, 99% of them. The church one, I give my condolences to the lady from Charleston. I lost a friend down there in San Diego, California. Let me tell you something else. It wouldn't matter if we had this. If a person's intent's going to be done, they shall do it. They're hell-bent, with all due respect. Let me give y'all something else. Y'all keep having this, using the emergency clause on these bills. I want you disenfranchising me as a voter, as a citizen. These rules that y'all putting on us is on law-abiding citizens who has a clean record, who served this country, who has done everything possible and will fight and support law enforcement when needed. It's a disenfranchisement. It's almost like, and I hate to say it, I'm going to go back about 100 years almost, it's almost like having Jim Crow laws throwing on law-abiding Americans. It's the same tactics that they use down south, whether it's George Wallace in Alabama or Woodrow Wilson when he allowed, after having first time the Democratic Party had gotten elected in the South by black people for majority in 1914 by Mr. Trotter, and then 6 months later he kicks him out and allows the Klansmen movement to roll and allows Jim Crow laws to exist, restricting, slowly boiling the frogs until we, the blacks down there, until Dr. King and various other leaders decide to empower them. I disrespect this rule. This rule does not have no time limit on how long before the state will respond. The last thing is, it's just, if you're going to, if y'all haven't even enforced your current rules in this, that we got on the books. I got a friend of mine, he made mistakes. The lady bought him a Gerald Branton. You can look it up in Linn County, June 29th, 2014. His girlfriend bought him a gun. Okay? You're not going to stop people of that nature. She claimed that she was gone. She gave a statement. I've tried, people said, do the right thing. None of y'all won't listen, state or anything else. They violate federal. Until you take care of those laws, until you go through, you're not going to stop. You're going to have these problems. It's a waste of my time. It's a waste of time. Next time, I would like to have a right to vote. And the last thing is, it's not fair on 941 because it takes away my right to spend time with my godson who served my country, comes out here. And I should have to have a background check and pay for a background check for the individual. Each time when we are law-abiding free citizens, it's an insult as a taxpayer. And you are disenfranchising us as Oregonians in general. And you're wondering why the hot mess is going on. People of us is getting tired. People of us is frustrated. You guys supposed to uphold, to legislate laws, but you legislate laws beyond and not getting the whole consensus. Give me the right to vote on it. I'm tired of you people going through and saying, we know your interests. I don't want to be like Australia. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it.
Okay. Go ahead, just call it. So we have next up, Carrie Selby, Rebecca Cohen, and Amy Wexler. And on deck, we have Manny Martinez, Jack Eichen Sr., and Frank, last name begins with an M, Martin, on deck next. Thank you for being here today. Please begin in whatever order you'd like, and state your name for the record, please.
Committee Chair Barker and the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of HB 4147. My name is Carrie Selby, and I'm a resident of Portland, Oregon. Like many citizens who become passionately engaged in activism around a specific issue that concerns them, I had my moment of crystallization that took me from bystander to activist. It was in the summer of 2014 when a 15-year-old boy took an AR-15 to Reynolds High School, killed another 14-year-old student, and then turned the gun on himself. My brother-in-law, Evan, is a teacher at Reynolds. And while I first heard the news, breaking news, my heart jumped when I thought, no, I'm sure Evan is fine. He couldn't possibly be hurt. And yeah, Evan was safe. But that is not the case with many gun violence survivors and families that I have met over the last couple years of my time with Moms Demand Action. They have suffered agonizing losses that are impossible for me to imagine, and I pray that I never have to. 88 Americans are killed with guns every day, and hundreds more are injured. While we understand that background checks on firearm purchases do not prevent all instances of gun violence, they are a critical barrier to keeping dangerous people, people who are not legally eligible to purchase a gun, from obtaining one. A background check should be a pass-fail with no exceptions, and the 3D loophole is an exception that must be closed. HB 4147 is an important step towards strengthening our background check system. And I urge a yes vote to send this forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, committee members, for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Rebecca Cohen. I am a mother and volunteer with Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. I'm also a gun violence survivor. My uncle was shot and killed when I was 14 years old. So like Reverend Risher and so many other people before you today, I know what it feels like to get that phone call. I'm here today to advocate on behalf of House Bill 4147, which strengthens Oregon's background check system by giving law enforcement the tools they need to complete background checks and follow up on checks that fail. I ask you to picture the following scenarios. Your blood test results aren't back yet, but since it's been 3 days, we'll just assume you don't have cancer. Your daughter ran a stop sign, but since her road test took longer than an hour, we'll just issue her a driver's license. Or we haven't completed your criminal background check yet, but school starts tomorrow, so go ahead, teach kindergarten. Sounds ridiculous, right? So why apply the same logic to something as important as to whether somebody is legally prohibited from purchasing a gun? When it comes to criminal background checks, we should give the process the time it needs. The background check system shouldn't be pass-fail. Felons, domestic abusers, and other dangerous people shouldn't be able to get a gun with an incomplete. It was a proud moment last spring when Oregon became the 18th state to require criminal background checks on all handgun sales. Like many, I had no idea that there was a 3-day time limit on the background check process. Tragically, it took the murder of 9 churchgoers in Charleston for many Americans to realize that this dangerous loophole even existed. With rights come responsibilities. We hear this often. Oregon has a responsibility to its citizens to complete the background check process on every firearm sale. Making sure these checks are completed, whether that takes less than 5 minutes, which is the case for 95% of background checks, or longer, is the best way to ensure that a prohibited buyer cannot purchase a weapon. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the Judiciary Committee, thank you very much for hearing my testimony. My name is Amy Wexler. I'm here in support of House Bill 4147. I'm a member of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in Oregon, as well as a concerned citizen, a lawyer, and a mother. I live in Portland, Oregon, in Representative Lou Frederick's district. I'm here today because, like so many Americans, I watched in horror as the news of the shooting in Charleston, South Carolina, broke. 9 members of the Emanuel AME Church's Bible study group were murdered by a man who should not have had a gun. The killer sought to purchase a weapon legally and had to undergo a background check. In the state of South Carolina, as is currently the case in Oregon, if 3 days pass without a check being completed, the applicant is allowed to purchase their weapon without the finished background check. The shooter's application would have been denied because of his arrest on felony drug charges had the FBI had time to uncover this information. This is unacceptable. We must close this loophole here in Oregon. There are too many times when a person attempts to purchase a gun in violation of their parole or a court's order, and it endangers too many people when their purchase goes through without that completed check. Additionally, HB 4147 would notify law enforcement if someone has attempted to purchase a gun and they were denied because of their background check. I have worked with survivors of domestic violence who deserve the right to know if the person who was ordered to turn over their weapons to law enforcement is now trying to buy a new weapon. I want to thank you for supporting Common Sense gun legislation in Oregon. I am a proud Oregonian for over 20 years. I know the vast majority of Oregonians are in support of background checks and closing this loophole. I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you for your support.
Thank you very much, panel. Manny Martinez, Jack Eichhorn Sr., and Frank Martin. On deck, Kara Murray, Zikra Lucan, and Ashley planned up, I think. Please go ahead, anybody start out and just identify yourself by name for the record.
My name is Manuel Martinez, also known as Manny Martinez. I give you two writings that I have that pretend to why I'm opposing this bill. This bill is a mockery. This bill prevents nothing. This bill don't prevent what is happening in this country right now. You are entertaining the people with rhetorics. You are entertaining the American people with fallacies. You are not telling the American people the danger that we have in this country right now. This country is collapsing. This country is disappearing if you don't do not something. You do not know what freedom is. You don't have the idea of that because you never lose it. You have people wearing those t-shirts who said, "Moms demand action," goes to the communist country, and you see them where they are. All of them assassinated. You do not know what freedom is. Period and simple. I've been there. I saw them. I watched them. I didn't read it in books. I didn't see in TV shows, in debates. I saw mothers playing for the life of their son before they were killed. And you are selling me to the American people this background check? Tell them down there. Tell them that they're going to have background checks there. Tell them. Mr. Chair, you do not know what freedom is. You're born in this country. You are very lucky to be here. There are millions of people that have died for the freedom that you have, which I doubted if you deserve it. How many of you have bought? How many of you have been in a communist country? And tell them the background check. You're selling a fallacy. You're selling an entertainment. You are not telling the truth. And if I have here time not for 3 minutes, I have 2 months to tell you the assassinations and what is happening and what this country should do.
Hey, thank you very much for your testimony on that.
Thank you, committee members. My name is Jack Eichhorn from West Salem, Oregon. And this bill takes away some of Oregon's rights, general rights as firearms. Therefore, they're taken away faster than we can, local and state police can enforce them. The police have been burdened with laws from 2 years ago that they can't enforce. And please take away don't take away our rights for the Second Amendment. For a note that Chicago, no guns allowed, when someone dies every day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Frank Martin. I hail from Gresham, and I'm here today to stand and oppose the portions of House Bill 4147, I apologize. My concern about this bill, I'm going to stand and say I agree everything that Kevin Starrett has stated earlier and the member of the NRA, but I'm going to state a little deal about this idea. I've been hearing all this testimony for the bill, and my impression is keep the guns out of the hand of the dangerous individuals. I agree with that, but the problem is it seems like anybody who applies to buy a firearm is considered a dangerous individual, and I consider that wrong. I happen to know this person who will probably be testifying later today that he's being denied. And he has no prior arrest, no mental health, no problem. Unfortunately, he's being delayed. Under this bill, his rights are taken away. And I'll read something here in my little testimony. Section 10 of the Oregon State Constitution, Administration of Justice, no court shall in secret, but justice shall be administered openly, without purchasing, completely without delay. Every man shall have a remedy by course of law for injury done for him in person, property, or his reputation. That applies to the courts, but I feel that this bill is giving the power to the Oregon Firearms Unit to be a court on individuals' reputation. If they don't, a clerical delay can delay the purchase, and they're denied a right to purchase a firearm. I consider this just one more step, a more delay to make it more difficult to own a firearm. Like I said, I'm not against background checks. I recently passed one last November. I had no problem. It was very quick and very easy. I'm former law enforcement myself and a retired military person. But for every little right that we kind of put these little controls on what they call a loophole, and if there's a clerical error, suddenly an individual loses their right to own a firearm. And I stand deathly opposed to that. And I find it difficult to understand why the majority of party continues to bring bills like this up for a vote. It just seems like the party itself is stating, we are not against firearms purchases, but anybody who purchases the firearms is considered a dangerous individual, and we got to close that loophole. I thank you.
Thank you very much.
Opportunity to speak.
Kara Murray, Zerka, no, I'm sorry, Zikra, thank you, Lucan and Ashley.
And then on deck.
And then on deck is Jim Michael, Tom Schurkamp, and Randy Probosco, I think.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Kara Murray, and I'm a mother of two boys, ages 12 and 7, and a business owner from Southwest Portland. I'm also a member of Moms Demand Action in America, a grassroots organization working towards common sense gun reform. I have taken the day off work to ask you to pass common sense gun legislation. I speak for my friends and relatives who are not able to be here today due to work or childcare schedules. The murder of 20 children and six educators at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012 spurred me to act to prevent gun violence. The murder of 9 parishioners in the sanctity of their Charleston church this past summer was another shock to our collective conscience. I'm calling on state legislators to pass HB 4147 to close the so-called Charleston loophole, which allows a gun sale to proceed after 3 days, even if the background check is incomplete. Our current background check system allows for the clock to run out after 3 days, and that's how the Charleston shooter, a prohibited purchaser, got his gun. HB 4147 also provides law enforcement with the information to arrest dangerous people who fail a background check bill before they can buy a gun online or through another type of unlicensed sale. This bill is about enforcing the law, plain and simple. It's exactly what the gun lobby says we should do to stop violence, enforcing existing laws. Yet they do nothing to help. We agree that we should enforce existing laws, and this is how we are trying to do something about it. At least 16 states and Washington, D.C. give authorities longer than 3 days to complete a background check. Last year, Oregon became a leader on gun violence prevention by becoming the 18th state to require criminal background checks on all handgun sales. We once again have the opportunity to lead on this issue by passing HB 4147. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. My name is Zikra Lucan, and I live in Portland. I am a volunteer for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in Oregon. It is my belief that as citizens and as people, if we have an opportunity to save a life, we are obliged to do everything within our power to try. I believe HB 4147 gives us this opportunity by the simple measure of keeping guns out of the hands of people who, by law, do not have the right to purchase them. I feel very fortunate that as an American living in 2016, my life has not been directly affected by gun violence. I am one of the lucky ones. but my heart breaks on a daily basis as I read story after story about those who have not been so fortunate. Children who will never grow up because they were victims of senseless gun violence. Families who must live with the loss of their loved ones in communities torn apart because, for example, a young man filled with hate was able to buy a gun he was not entitled to simply because of a loophole in the law. If we have the opportunity to save even one life, it is incumbent upon us to try. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Ashley Planalp, and I am from Albany, Oregon. And I also am I chair the art program, the volunteer art program at my daughter's elementary school. And I am the Every Town Moms Demand Action volunteer survivor engagement lead for the state of Oregon. I know that that's a bit of a mouthful. But through my advocacy work, I work closely with victims of gun violence and families that have been torn apart because of guns. On average in this country, 88 people die each day from a gunshot wound. Gun violence is a public health issue, and I feel that it should be treated as such. Yesterday was National Women's Physician Day. And if you were to ask any physician, what's the most effective way to address a public health issue, they would say through prevention. And that is exactly what House Bill 4147 does. It allows law enforcement adequate time to investigate people that have not been able to pass a background check. And as of right now, we have the Charleston loophole. So after three business days, if somebody does not pass a background check, then people are allowed to sell them a gun. So in order to do my volunteer work at the elementary school, I have to pass a background check in order to do that. My daughter is also in Girl Scouts, and I have to pass a background check just to be allowed on the premises to pick up my daughter at Girl Scouts. And that's something that I have to do. I'm not trying to like purchase a dangerous weapon or anything like that. That is just so I can go and get my own daughter from Girl Scouts. I don't think anyone here would advocate for if I had an incomplete background check that I should be allowed into a classroom full of children and be allowed to teach them art classes if I don't pass a background check. People should not be allowed to purchase a deadly weapon if they have an incomplete background check. And that's why I'm asking you to pass House Bill 4147. In closing, I'd like to say a few things about Moms Demand Action. Last year at this time, we had 70 active volunteers. Now we have over 700, and we have 75,000 members across the state. So we are having more and people join our cause and realizing that gun violence is something that is not going to go away anytime soon. And there are more and more people that are here willing to support and pay attention to what is going on with our lawmakers. And we're paying attention to how you vote. And we are a very, we will show up on election day and we will thank you on social media. And we send cards thanking you for your vote, and we're generally a nice people to have on your side.
Thank you very much. Jim Mischel, Tom Schurkamp, and Randy Probasco. On deck, Kate Soren, Marge Easley, and Larry Hall. Please go ahead, anybody. Go ahead and start and just identify yourself with your name. And
hi, thanks for the opportunity. My name is Randy Probasco. I'm a small business owner in Beaverton. The reason I'm here is I've been a gun collector for years. I've had no less than 20 approved background checks with the Oregon State Police. But the latest one being in July, and I went out on Black Friday to buy a weapon and delayed. System's broken. It is now 100 days later, and I'm still delayed. I got a call 9 days after I applied, and they hadn't even started in an investigation on it yet. They said that I had an arrest in 1979. I did have an arrest in 1979. It was not a domestic violence, not a felony, nothing that would preclude me from getting a weapon. I have with me my federal firearms license. The federal government has approved me to buy and sell guns over the internet to other dealers or to myself for my collection. I have a concealed carry license in 34 states because I traveled a lot in my motorhome. But yet I cannot buy a weapon now. Why? I called the state and left no less than 7 messages, voicemail and email. Finally, a week ago, 90 days later, I got a call from the OSP, and they told me that every time I call, I'm on the list here, they move me down to the bottom. Unacceptable in any business, any government agency, to do things like that. I don't know what's wrong. The system's broken. It's completely, completely broken. I'm an individual, small business owner. We don't have the money that Bloomberg provides these people to lobby you guys. It's up to us, and we will organize, and we will do like the last person did. We'll threaten you. I would rather not do that with votes and rallies and all that. I'd like to think that you have the common sense to know that we have enough gun laws, and there's certain things that are just basic common sense gun laws. We already have them. We live in an information age where everything is instantaneously available. Why are they not getting the information they need? That's the problem. That's the problem. There's no reason for it. I yield. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm just a citizen. I don't have a prepared statement. I'm from Sheridan, and I have a concealed carry permit.
And you need to state your name, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Tom Sherkamp.
Thank you.
Yes, I don't have a prepared statement, but I can see from listening to other people here give their little testimonies that this law is not going to work. It's just like these gun-free zones don't work. People still walk in there with guns. And my only statement here is that you can't legislate goodness or stop an idiot. A crook is not going to go into Bi-Mart and go through a background check. So background checks are only for the honest people who walk in and want to buy a gun. And that's about all I have to say, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jim Mitchell. I'm from Sheridan, retired law enforcement and 13 years military. I submitted a written statement, so I'm not going to go over that, but there's a couple of things here that have got me curious, and perhaps my old abilities and investigations is lacking. We've heard from South Carolina, which is a long ways from Oregon, and I ran a background check myself last night through the South Carolina Department of Justice. And what I got back was that this idiot in South Carolina, and I'm keeping my terms nice for him, was only arrested on a misdemeanor. I've heard several felony charges replied. I've got the report right here, and I sent it in with my written testimony. A loophole. The FBI background investigation showed an arrest for drug charges. Why wasn't it stopped? Right there. The man did one of two things. He either lied on his 4473 form where it asks you about drug use, which is a denial, or he was arrested on a drug charge, which would cause him a denial. But there was no conviction. In the U.S., it's innocent until proven guilty. So forget the drug arrest. Let's go to why didn't you say you used drugs on your form? Why wasn't he denied? Why did there have to be additional investigation? The clerk should have stamped it right there. I'm sure we could check with the captain back here, but I think that probably would have happened in Oregon. The second they came up with a CCH showing a drug arrest, all sorts of bells, whistles, and flags would have been flying. as far as people in Oregon not wanting some people to have guns, boy, is that a loaded question. You bet there's people in Oregon I wouldn't want to have guns. That doesn't necessarily mean I'm in favor of tightening down on background checks. I mean, there's people in the state pen I don't want to have guns. There's people on parole I don't want to have guns, and I have a mother-in-law I don't want to have a gun. But that has absolutely nothing to do with why my son was denied for a month and a half because his name was similar to somebody that was in the state penitentiary in Walla Walla. Now, excuse me, but it doesn't take a lot of sense to see if you have an inmate in Walla Walla, Washington, he probably isn't standing in Beaverton, Oregon, buying a gun. I was denied one time. Now, this was, the background checks weren't as advanced as they are now. This was still back during the five-day period. But you know what it's like to be standing in a police uniform at a gun counter being told you're not going to be allowed to purchase the duty weapon that's sitting right there in front of you? It took a week and a half to get that straightened out. So it's, we had a law passed last year that was so wonderful. All sorts of amendments to it were turned down because they weren't necessary. It was a perfect law. And here we are now. We have some kind of a big loophole that really does not exist. I'm out of time.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you all for your testimony.
Thank you.
Kate Soren, Marge Easley, and Larry Hall.
On deck.
On deck, Chris Warner, Dan Sandini, and Lee Richardson.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Kate Soren, and I'm a domestic violence advocate with the Center for Hope and Safety here in Marion County. And I am here in support of House Bill 4147. Last session, the legislature took two important steps designed to keep guns away from people who would otherwise be prohibited by laws for possessing or purchasing. They expanded the kinds of sales that were subject to background checks, and they added the federal domestic violence prohibitions for people who were subject to a restraining order or convicted of a domestic violence crime to Oregon's list of prohibitions to make it easier to provide safety for domestic violence victims. We greatly appreciate those steps as an important recognition that the combination of guns and domestic violence is dangerous. In an average year, around 20% of all homicides are related to domestic violence, and approximately two-thirds of those homicides involve use of a firearm. Nationwide, the risk of homicide is 20 times greater where there has been an established history of domestic violence and a combination of ready access to guns. Research shows that domestic violence abusers who possess guns tend to use them as part of a pattern of abuse and power and control to ready the further threat as a tool of psychological control and mistreatment. Many victims live under the constant shadow of firearm-related violence against themselves and their children. But steps taken last year did leave that crucial gap we've been speaking of. Under current law, if a background check cannot be completed within the narrow time window, the sale must be allowed, even if there are indicators that this person is a prohibited purchaser. For example, like we said, criminal history may show that they're prohibited because of domestic violence conviction in another state. And if further information is needed for that, and it's not done within that time frame, they can still purchase that, even though that sale can still go through, even though there is that indicator that the person is a prohibited purchaser. House Bill 4147 will close that important gap in our law. It does not increase prohibitions, but it ensures that we will not allow the sales of dangerous weapons until we're satisfied that that purchaser has not been prohibited. There were 46 Oregonians killed last year in 2015 due to domestic violence, and the vast majority of those deaths were by firearms. Domestic violence victims in Oregon deserve protections from gun violence, and the state has a responsibility to ensure that its prohibitions are enforced. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Barker, for allowing me to testify. I'm Larry Hall. I'm a retired pediatrician from Roseburg, Oregon. I also am a firearm owner. I have two hunting rifles. And I would like to speak in support of 4147. I've been a lifelong professional advocate for firearm safety. My professional organization, the Academy of Pediatrics, has long supported firearm safety and programs that assure that youngsters will be safe from firearms in the home, such things as safe storage, trigger locks, storage of weapons away from bullets. We went to a lot of work in the 90s to advocate for laws that would make parents and gun owners responsible for safe storage of weapons. We lose some 400 youngsters every year just because they accidentally discharge a firearm and kill somebody. That is just remarkable. Let me speak just a minute to the events in Douglas County. On October 1st, UCC experienced a massacre by a deranged young man. That changed Douglas County forever. Community College is still deeply grieving. It will never be the same. We never wanted to be Newtown or Columbine, but we now are. And how did we react? I don't know of anybody who's qualified to speak to the grief and the sadness and the sorrow of the people of Roseburg. So what happened? Well, a lot of things happened. One is that we received $1.3 million in unsolicited funds to kind of deal in some way or to help in some way with the care of those who were affected by that horrible event. I got a lot of calls from people who said, what can we do? And I will tell you that there are a number of organizations in town that are meeting on a fairly regular basis and asking that question. We have people going to the school district and saying, what can we do to make students safer in our schools? Big issue. I had a mother tell me that I really shouldn't bother at all with guns because they were too much, people were too attached to them. And I said, well, what would you do? Oh, and then she showed me a picture of her grandchild. And I said, you know, that's a lovely, lovely grandchild. What would you do to make that grandchild's life safer? And she said, oh, I would do anything. So we're dealing with something here that's really important. 33,000. Am I through? Okay.
Just wrap up.
Well, let me just say that this bill is imperfect. It does add something, and I submit that bills like this do have some effect. It may be little, but it can make the lives of our children, our grandchildren, and our communities a little safer. And thank you.
Thank you very much,
Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marge Easley, and I'm here representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League positions on gun safety and violence prevention inform our belief that it's the responsibility of government, legislators like you, to enact and enforce public safety legislation such as firearm background checks. We believe that HB 4147 is a logical step forward to make Oregon's background check system work more fairly and effectively by eliminating the default proceed provision. The Oregon State Police firearms instant check system works very efficiently the vast majority of time. OSP records indicate that 94% of background checks are approved within minutes of initiation, which is actually better than the 91% average of the national instant background check system, which has been advocated by others in today. However, there are instances when confirmation may be delayed due to times of high volume, out-of-state delays, or simple human error in the processing procedure. No system is absolutely 100% perfect all of the time. We firmly believe that the default in these situations should not be to grant automatic approval after three days. We believe that concern for public safety dictates that the default should be to err on the side of caution and wait for a determination of whether a person is qualified or disqualified to receive that firearm. We believe that this is a step forward, that our background check laws will work better if this loophole would be removed, and the League urges passage of HB 4147.
Okay, thank you. Chris Wagner, Dan Sandini, and Lee Richard. Okay. On deck, Chloe Massarello, Penny Okamoto. Okay. Please go ahead and just remember to identify yourself by name.
Representative Barker, thank you very much for having me. My name is Dan Sandini. I live in Multnomah County. I am a citizen journalist. I'm an IT specialist. I have two master's degrees, one in software engineering, and I have an MBA from Northeastern University. I graduated in the top 1% of the graduates there, and I have 20 years with the MITRE Corporation, which is a pretty esteemed corporation, working for the government, working with the U.S. military. I'm also a person who's had ROTC experience, so I have a little bit of military experience, not very much. I am very much opposed to this bill that we have today. I had the fortunate experience of going to a town hall where Representative Williamson on Saturday spoke about this bill. In her own numbers, Representative Barton, in her own numbers, she said that that last year alone, 1,800 people would be rejected. They would be rejected. And I would ask everyone's attention while I'm speaking about my rights in this room right now. You should be embarrassed, and the people who are knitting should be embarrassed that they're not paying attention when we speak about our rights. These are our rights as human beings, okay? Free human beings in a society. And we should pay attention when people are talking about those rights. I'm insulted that people weren't during this testimony. By her own numbers, Representative Williamson said 1,800 people would be rejected. Of those 1,800, only 500 of those people should have really been rejected. Now, what about those 1,300 people that got rejected that could not own a firearm because they got rejected, but they should be able to own a firearm? She said in her own statements, and you can look on my YouTube channel to see it, okay, she said in her own statements that out of Los Angeles County, it would take 6 months for them to get the information that they needed. So all somebody would have had to have done is file a restraining order against somebody, and they would be rejected. You wouldn't be able to find out whether that disqualified them or not. Now, I call this the pro-rape bill, and I would ask each one of those moms demand actions, and communism doesn't always wear red, okay? Sometimes it wears orange. And this is from somebody who's lived in Europe for 8 years of my life. I've seen it before. I would ask them to speak to those 1,300, possibly women, who were rejected from owning a firearm and are now victim to rape and violent assault. And those women that have to walk through Chinatown and walk through downtown Portland, where I live, unprotected, at the mercy of these people who are being released from the prison system, some of them violent felons in downtown Portland, I would ask them to apologize to the women whose rights they want to take away. I'm out of my time, and thank you very much for hearing my testimony today, Representative Barker.
Thank you.
My name is Lee Richardson. I own Rich's Gun Shop, which has been in business for over 50 years. And during that time, I have seen the problems that law-abiding citizens have had with the Oregon State Police in trying to purchase firearms. One day, a customer will be delayed for months. Then they will come back a few days later to purchase another gun and be approved immediately. Most of the time, customers can't even get through to anyone to ask questions, etc. We cannot and must not give the Oregon State Police any more power than they already wield, as they have proven thus far that they cannot be trusted to uphold the laws and procedures already on the books. Kevin Sterrett from the Oregon Firearms Federation has been instrumental in stopping their lawless efforts to usurp authority over firearms purchasers. We have seen it time and time again, the many stories. We know all too well from history what happens when a person or governmental group gains too much power. This is a very bad bill and would be a huge mistake if passed for all law-abiding citizens and could lead to a frightening reality of restricting our right to purchase a firearm for home defense even further. Actually, we have lost so many of our firearms rights that we can see America falling down the same slippery slope that so many other socialist countries in the world have. This is not good and not what we need as Americans. We must stop these types of bills at the pass and work hard to restore our firearms rights in all aspects. The principles and ideals this country is founded on are heaven-sent and are proven to keep a nation strong and healthy. Those ideals never change unless people want them to change. Jennifer Williamson's dislike of firearms and of the record number of firearm sales is her personal problem, not ours. She has no right to suggest her socialistic agenda on anybody but herself. I would like to know how many of your constituents want what you want, Jennifer. Remember who is here to serve who. Listen to the voice of the people, not your own, please. We are again at the point of where George Washington said, "The time is near at hand which must determine whether Americans are to be free men or slaves." You politicians, stop this nonsense of attempting to create your own laws in the vain hope of thinking that you can save the world. Hopefully, you will realize that you really do not have any power to save anyone. And all you will do is fail, like so many others, at accomplishing anything good or worthwhile. I commend those of you here that oppose 4147 and hope that it goes up in flames as it should. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Wagner. I'm a gun owner, and I have to fully support what many of the other people have said in opposition to this proposed law. I have recently purchased several guns, gone through the background check process, and thank goodness I was able to get through with no problems. But I have no criminal history, no violations. I haven't even had a speeding ticket for decades when I was a lot less fluffier and a lot more frisky. This law, proposed law, is only for law-abiding citizens. The criminals, the people who don't care about laws, will not pay any attention to it. And I can give you proof of that right now. If everybody in this room that's a law-abiding citizen will raise their hand. Anyone who is a criminal, has a criminal history in this room, raise your hand now. They will not come to a meeting like this to testify for or against it. They don't care what law you come up with. They are not going to comply with it. And that's why this law is a complete waste of time, money, and effort. There are laws on the books that cover everything that needs to be done, and we should not be impinging on our freedoms for this misguided attempt. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your testimony. Chloe Massarello and Penny Okamoto, please. And on deck is Michael Strickland, Ruben Hanna, and Greg Terhune. Either one, or just identify yourself by name, please.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Chloe Massarello. I'm the training coordinator at the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, and I am here in support of House Bill 4147. A firearm is a tool that domestic violence perpetrators utilize to increase power and control over their victims. In the hands of domestic violence perpetrators, firearms are employed to intimidate, punish, threaten, and end the lives of their chosen victims, and sometimes their own lives. Firearms are tools that escalate the severity and increase the ease of exercising power and control in abusive relationships. Murder is the ultimate act of power control that an abuser can exercise. It represents the annihilation of the victim's autonomy. In Oregon, in any given year, approximately 60% of domestic violence fatalities result from the use of a firearm. From 2003 through 2015, a minimum of 249 people were killed in our state in this manner. Access to firearms increases the risk of fatality in domestic violence situations. My experience serving on the Oregon Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team, answering crisis calls and speaking with community programs through my role at the Oregon Coalition, and researching this topic indicates that this final act is almost always preceded by a pattern of abuse that is severe enough to leave imprints in the local community. Someone, some organization, some hospital, some police agency knows that there is abuse. Delaying the sale of a firearm until a background check has been completed is protective to victims. It ensures that proper precaution has been exercised before access is provided to a weapon that is often used as a tool of abuse by domestic violence perpetrators. Oregon State Police data confirms that domestic violence perpetrators have been denied access to firearms through our background check system. The Oregon Coalition represents 48 of the state's 56 domestic and sexual violence community organizations and works extensively with the rest. It is these organizations and their partners that work to keep victims safe and to support surviving family members in the event of the worst outcome. On behalf of these programs and advocates, I urge you to increase the safety of domestic violence victims and their family members through passage of House Bill 4147. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Okamoto.
Thank you very much, Chair Barker and members of the House Judiciary Committee. I'm Penny Okamoto. I'm the Executive Director of Ceasefire Oregon. Ceasefire Oregon supports HB 4147. This bill will enforce existing laws, including longstanding laws, prohibiting felons, abusers, fugitives from justice, and others from buying guns. So we've already heard about last June 17th, when 9 people were gunned down at the Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, after a man was able to buy a gun without completing a background check. Had the gun seller been required to complete the check, 9 Americans worshiping in their own church might not have been gunned down. From 2004 until 2014, gun dealers throughout the United States have gone forward with 15,729 gun sales to prohibited people because a background check could not be completed within 3 business days. So again, that's 15,729 people who were prohibited got a gun anyway because of this Charleston loophole. According to FBI data, more than 20% of these proceed default or Charleston loophole sales, where a final determination is made by the FBI, involve sales of firearms to prohibited individuals. So I'll restate that. About 20% of these sales, when the FBI has been able to determine a final outcome, 20% go to people who should have been prohibited. An analysis of FBI data by Mayors Against Illegal Guns found, quote, default proceed sales are more than 8 times more likely to be associated with a prohibited purchaser than sales where the purchaser's background check is resolved within 3 days. So let's think about this logically. Would a bank give someone a home loan if a person's credit check was not complete? Would a parent hire a caregiver if a background check wasn't complete? Of course not. Why are we allowing gun sellers to sell a gun when a firearm check is not complete? We know that Walmart, for example, will not sell a gun until the check is complete. Oregon should not let prohibited buyers obtain a gun simply because of a loophole placed into the law. The so-called burden of waiting for a completed check is certainly much less of a burden than the survivors of the Mother Emanuel AME survivors are carrying today. Please keep our background check system strong and protect Oregonians. Gun violence is preventable. Ceasefire Oregon urges you to support HB 4147. I thank you very much for your time and consideration on this important issue.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Michael Strickland, Ruben Hanna, and Greg Terhune. Next on the list, Nicholas Coffey, Dale Burrs, Robert Gordon. Go ahead.
My name is Ruben Hanna. I come to you today as a father of eight, an average citizen of Oregon, and in opposition of this bill. I don't have the eloquent words of those preceding me. I have a few questions for you today as well as a few statements. First, how will this law make my family and I safer? How does making it harder for good people to protect themselves make them safer? If a criminal wants to do harm, they will find a way despite a new law on the books. As the leader of my home, it is my duty to protect my family and provide for their safety. I am my wife and children's first responder. This law makes it more difficult for me to protect my family by adding yet another layer of red tape for me to get through to secure the necessary tools to do my job. The NICS background check is a failure on its face. It presumes that dangerous people can be made safe while they walk free, which is an absurd notion, and therefore we should not support it in any manner. Doing so just encourages the practice of allowing dangerous people in a free society. The system is now backed up to the point that NICS is not even processing appeals currently, which results in a large number of people being wrongfully denied their rights. They're being denied most frequently because their names match someone else that is in the system. Criminals don't use this system to begin with. Bad people will do bad things no matter what laws are in place. If passed, this bill would quite possibly deny law-abiding citizens their constitutional rights indefinitely. Just because our current system doesn't really work doesn't mean we should add more laws. That is not a solution. With the consistent erosion of our constitutional rights, how much more tyranny will Oregonians be subjected to? I have committed no crimes. Why are my rights being attacked yet again? Owning a firearm is not an entitlement. It is my constitutional right. And last, what part of the phrase "shall not be infringed" are you having a hard time understanding? This bill needs to be rejected. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Michael Strickland. I come to you today as a victim of violence from the anti-gun side. I guess they don't like it when they get caught in their lies, so their reaction is to lash out in violence and steal video cameras. It's really no wonder they want more background checks, because they don't trust themselves, because it's their side that's prone to lashing out in violence, so they think everybody else does the exact same thing. I find it really ironic that the carrier of this bill, Representative Williamson, has also gone on record for advocating for letting violent people out of jail early before their sentences are up. She's actually gone out there and said she wants to repeal Measure 11. I'm wondering how that's going to help public safety. And I find it really ironic that the people from Moms Demand Action and Ceasefire Oregon are actually aligning themselves with somebody who wants to let violent people out of jail early. I also hear, Chairman Barker, that you have already decided long before the hearing that you were going to vote for this. So why even have the hearing? Is this just some kind of theater, some charade of some sort? If you've already made up your mind, then why continue with these proceedings? Last year, we were told by the people from Moms Demand Action, all we want are background checks. That's all we're talking about. And whenever anybody else would bring up anything else, like, no, 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 all we're talking about is universal back. Now they want more stuff. Now they want this. Now they want that. They like to talk about the slippery slope being a fallacy, yet they continue to push for more and more gun laws, just as the pro-gun people fear they actually do. I'm also curious. Last year they kept saying that background checks only take 90 seconds. It's not going to bother anyone, yet here they are telling us that the most sophisticated law enforcement agency in the world can't do a background check in 3 days. Which is it? I'm also wondering, what is a right and what is a permission? Do rights require permission? Do we have to beg for a free speech permit? Do we have to get a special little card that means we have our Fourth Amendment protections? Do we have to go through some kind of background check to make sure we get a trial by jury? How many amendments do we need permissions in order to have? It's really ironic that it is now a crime to not prove innocence. Anybody who supports this is basically saying everybody is guilty, and now you have to prove your innocence. And if you don't prove your innocence, you're committing a crime. So I'm also wondering where the bill is to fix
the background check system, so it does not take 3 days to figure out if somebody should be prohibited or not. It shouldn't take that long in the first place. Where is the bill to fix that, to make sure that doesn't happen, so we don't have these people coming back and saying, this is a loophole, and that's a loophole, and everything's a loophole. The First Amendment is a loophole. Everything's a loophole. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Nicholas Coffey, Dale Burris, and Robert Gordon. Just go ahead, anybody start, and just remember to identify yourself by name, please.
My name's Dale Burris. I'm from Dallas, Oregon. I'm very angry that I feel I have the need to be here to defend something that I thought was established even before the Constitution. Before the Constitution, people in this country had the right to keep arms. They fought for that right and won it against the English, fought the English again for that right. Men in this country and women have defended this country with firearms. The pioneer on top of this Capitol building came across this country bearing arms to feed his family and to protect himself. We have arms since man has been man. There's been legislation starting with the Code of Hammurabi, I can't even think of it now. Well, the Magna Carta, before that, in the Bible, the commandments, the Ten Commandments. All of these laws going back then have always been trying to control people's ambitions, their actions, their morals. How successful have they been? How many laws are just this country trying to control our actions? Most of them are punitive. A lot of them are fiscally punitive. But this one goes against, you know, our basic natures, going back to, you know, the Stone Age, which is named after what? The weapons they use, the Bronze Age, and so on. Now we have something that they call loopholes. Loopholes, common sense, those words and so many words have been violated to change political viewpoints. And I really, in my years, you know, have seen a lot of changes. And for one thing, I feel fortunate to have lived through a different era, not the one that I see coming. What I see coming, I don't like. Unfortunately, I don't have that long to live, so I won't have to suffer through them. But I have children, two sons. I have grandchildren, and they'll probably have children. What kind of world are we going to be living in where you want to take some kind of loophole? Has any of these laws prevented any of the violence? It's, if you really want to do something, put some conditions, make mandatory sense. Anybody does a violent crime with a firearm, they should be given mandatory sentences. So many of these things are just lawyered out. If you got a gun crime, they lawyer it out, and they don't prosecute them for them. So you don't prosecute the gun crimes. Why bother with them?
Okay, thank you. That's okay. Thank you.
My name's Nicholas Coffey, and somebody said something about socialism. I'm pretty much a socialist myself. I'm going to vote for Bernie Sanders, and I just wanted you to know that. There's been a lot of emotional testimony today, and I think it's incredible the amount of influence money has in our culture right now. Donald Trump can run for president, we should all be embarrassed. Mr. Bloomberg can finance opposition to firearms in Oregon. He can send people here to campaign against gun ownership. And this bill shouldn't even have been brought up in this session. When we passed Measure 71, it was so we could handle budget issues. This bill is a sneak attack on gun ownership. And it's incremental gun banning. Now, the state police, if the state police aren't up to the job of doing instant background checks, then we should turn it over to the FBI. Or we should go back to the old system. Under the old system, I wasn't delayed buying a firearm. I have a concealed weapons permit, and I could go in. It's a much more rigorous background check to get a concealed weapons permit. And I didn't have any problem buying firearms then, but I've been delayed numerous times. And the ironic thing is that if I bought a gun and then came back next week and bought another one, there wouldn't be any problem at all. I'd be instantly improved. But if I waited a couple of years, then they're going to investigate, or they're going to delay, or they're going to delay. And if I call up to find out what's going on, as has already been mentioned, I'm down at the bottom of the list. This is wrong. And giving the state police that much power so that they can passively, aggressively deny people by just not doing something is wrong. And it violates people's rights, and it violates due process. So I thank you for your time.
Robert Gordon came down from Portland, and I'm opposed to this bill. It supposes that a hold on a transfer is needed if within 30 minutes they are unable to determine if the purchaser is qualified or unqualified. And if a purchaser happens to be someone that has reason to doubt the safety of relying on a restraining order. Restraining orders are printed on this. And finds out that for some reason they're going to have a wrenching multiple days delay. Is this legislation good? Do denied people have to die because they cannot protect themselves? This bill supposes that legislators, by coming up with a sentence in Section 1, are responsible for our safety and can foil criminals. Legislators are not responsible for our safety, for if they claim responsibility, they have to accept liability for our safety. Raise your hand if you're accepting liability. No takers. Okay. Each person in this hearing is responsible for their own safety, and that includes the ability to arm themselves. And there's multiple reasons for violence, and the guns are not always involved. There's mental people, sociopaths, psychopaths, maniacs. There's a list. You're not going to be able to control those people with legislation. The vast majority of people are not going to be a problem. It's just there are some people that you need protection against, and coming up with some magic denial, how'd that come up? You're helpless. Oppose this.
Okay, thank you. And I just would say, when I was a little boy, my mother told me, in America, anybody can be president, and after this election cycle, I believe her. Yeah. John Grandstaff, please. Just remember to identify yourself by name for the record, please.
Yes, sir.
You came up and everybody left.
Story of my life. You're Mitch, right? And Brent? And Ann?
Well, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Jeff? And Sherry? And Jessica, right? Bill, I've been emailing you back and forth. And Andy's not here, or Wayne, right?
There's a death in the family.
Oh, that's too bad. My condolences. Okay. My name is John Grandstaff, and I'm here to testify against HB 4147. So this bill not only gives the Oregon State Police an unprecedented amount of power, it's also a blatant violation of the 2nd, 5th, and 14th Amendments of the United States Constitution, not to mention the right of due process that's enumerated in the Oregon Constitution. So with all due respect to the Oregon State Police ID unit, I have to ask, why would you give more power to an organization that hasn't been fulfilling its duty in the first place? Attempting to purchase a firearm when you're a prohibited person is a crime, it's a felony. Out of the hundreds of felons who attempted to purchase a gun last year from a licensed dealer, only a few were arrested, let alone prosecuted. On top of that, many more thousands of Oregonians have been unjustly denied or delayed the right to purchase a firearm when they weren't a prohibited person at all. So this bill passes, the state police will be able to delay somebody the right to purchase a firearm indefinitely with no recourse afforded to the citizen at all. It makes me seriously wonder if the OSP is so understaffed that they need more help. And if they do need more help, then let's make this bill about appropriating more money for their ID unit and hiring more officers. If they need more time, then let's give them more time, but not an indefinite amount. So I would challenge the OSP on this whole thing, and I would ask them to make a statement if they're for or against, if they're actually thirsting for power or they're just floundering here. Like, what is the real deal? So really what I want to say here is to allow a citizen to lose his or her rights just because an organization can't do its job is a violation of due process, just on its face. So which brings me to my next point here. Given that this bill is extremely unconstitutional, it'd be a violation of your guys' oaths to vote yes on it. If you vote yes on this bill, you will be breaking your oath of office, and that is a crime. Now, I know Bill, I'm assuming Bill and Sherry and Wayne and Andy are on board to vote no on this, and I would urge you to do the same. Because let's face it, we all know the Democratic Party is running a little bit of a dictatorship here. Whatever they push to the floor, it's gonna be turned into a law. So I would urge the rest of you to not be criminals, not break your oath of office, and vote no on this bill.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Comments from the, I don't believe we have anybody else.
Anybody else?
So, comments, please, Representative Springer.
thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Something I heard, I lost track of how many times today, that has caused me concern that I hadn't thought about before I walked into this room, is domestic violence victims. There are domestic violence victims that, I was a cop, I've seen this happen. They get their order, they leave the abuser. We even heard that, I think from the League of Oregon Voters, it's 20 times greater chance of, when there's a pattern of abuse, for the abusee to be injured by the abuser. What if that a domestic violence victim goes, if they choose, they don't have to get a gun, and they fail the background check. So the very person that we've talked about protecting could be compromised. So I want to put that on the record. I might be looking at amendment language for that. That's a concern that was brought up no less than a dozen times today.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments? Committee, thank you, everybody that attended today. Appreciate you taking the time to come down. And committee, I appreciate you spending the extra time with us today to let these people testify.
Dinner at your house?
We stand adjourned. Actually, I have to go to my house because I have to get glasses in the morning.